All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast, the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight is episode 198 of the show, and we're going to try to talk about I guess it qualifies as a movie. It's almost 90 minutes. It is called Gentlemen Broncos, and it should be a fair amount of fun to dissect and discuss tonight with our guest. And also, unfortunately, I have bad news. Robert, my co-host and hetero life mate, has had an internet outage as a result of wildfires. So I will give a little bit more detail in the last night's portion of the show. So normally the repartee that might happen during this section is not so much going to happen. However, I can tell you as an update on his business that he was shut down yesterday as a result of the fires being so nearby and the smoke that was blowing in. There were high winds and fires up in the hills near him, so they had to shut down early yesterday. But otherwise, I think business has been going pretty well for him. So we'll get an update from him the next time that we see him, and hopefully we might even try to do another recording session so we can get his hate-watching comments related to this movie, because I'm pretty sure, as he doesn't like the Napoleon Dynamite style, Nacho Libre type movies, this is the same director, I'm pretty sure he would have plenty of things to say about this and give it a very, very low score. So hopefully we can do something like that. But without further ado, I will usher us into the last night's portion of the show and introduce our guest right after these messages. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and what should be Robert Paul Johnson, and we are the Last Nighters. However, my guardian angel, Robert Johnson, is otherwise detained by a forest fire, a mostly peaceful wildfire, which is probably the result of a maskless gender reveal that was conducted without proper social distancing, and it's denatted my co-host, rendering him unable to connect to the internet at this time. However, I will let you know on this episode, Last Nighters, 141, also found on Launchpad Media, that we do have a very fine guest in the wings here who is about to be introduced. He is Dirty J, and he is a listener of the show. I'm surprised that there are listeners, but there are. I have evidence, photographic evidence, as I'm about to put him on screen here. Welcome to the show, Dirty J. You are my Exhibit A that we actually do have listeners, so thank you for proving my wife wrong. We actually do have a listener. Take that, wife. And Dirty J, let's talk a little bit about where your name came from and where this suggestion came from, because you emailed us a couple of weeks back and you're like, hey, I think that Gentlemen Broncos might be right up your alley, guys.
Well, okay. Well, first of all, you know, thanks for having me on the show. Big fan. Well, one of me and the other four people that are big fans, I guess.
Yeah, if I can count it on one hand.
As far as the nickname goes, it's a nickname I got back when I was in the serving in the military industrial complex. You know, we only go by last names, and my last name happens to be Johnson. And one of the guys that was in charge of me, he thought I was a dirty person. I was a mechanic. But I was, I always got especially dirty, even for being a mechanic. So he's like, man, you're a dirty guy. I'm going to call you Dirty Johnson. I'm like, whatever, you know. Then later on, he shortened it up to Dirty J. And I'm like, you know what? That actually has a ring to it. So I'm going to keep it. So, you know, ever since then, I've used Dirty J as a handle for a lot of stuff, you know, social media accounts. And, you know, I meet a new group of people at work. I'll be like, yeah, people just call me Dirty J or J for short. You know.
All right. Very cool. Yeah. Robert was also a Johnson. And back when we were in high school, there was a line of T-shirts called Big Johnson. and it would have like poker in the front, or wait, liquor in the front, poker in the rear. But it was, you know, like liquor, like at a bar, and poker, like playing poker. Yeah. So like puns, unfunny puns. Now they're like dad jokes, bad t-shirts.
Oh, but, God.
So sometimes he'd go by Big Johnson, and I was also nicknamed by a girl in my band class. Not that I was in a band, like a cool band. I was in a freaking band class, like an orchestra type band. A girl in there called me Dirty Boy. Yeah, Dirty Boy. I think when I was maybe a freshman or a sophomore, she was like a year or two older. And it was because I would make, you know, lewd, crude, fart joke humor. And some people would say I've matured. Others would know better. So I'll just leave it at that. Anyway, Dirty J, where did the recommendation come from?
Okay, well, the recommendation for your show, anyway, that was all me. But to give you the backstory of where I found this movie, a few years ago, my best friend, he told me about this movie, and he told me it was horrible. He actually said he got to the point where spoiler, where the battle stag got slammed into the wall and exploded by a stream of projectile vomit. He said he turned it off and quit watching it after that. And I'm just like, that sounds weird, man, but I'm gonna give it a shot and watch it. And I sat through it and I made it through it. And I don't know. I was actually listening to y'all's podcast and thinking of some movies that would fit it. And, you know, as horrible as this movie was, this one just popped up in the back of my head as far as something that could be discussed from a ANCAP libertarian standpoint because of the whole, because of the theme of it, you know?
All right. That's a bold statement. That's a bold statement, Cotton. Let's see if it holds up for you. And, you know, my original open when I was going to introduce you and the movie that we're talking about, here's Dirty J, and he suggested this movie, Gentleman Broncos. I was going to say, what the fuck, dude?
Honestly, part of the reason I suggested it that I didn't mention was, yes, I thought it would legitimately be a good talk for this show. But also, yeah, I kind of wanted to troll you guys into watching a horrible movie. I'm not going to lie. I mean, I don't know if that counts as an act of aggression. Maybe it should. The fact that I lured you guys into watching this.
Yeah, it's like a honeypot almost. You tricked us. It's almost fraud. Almost.
Misery loves company, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, spoilers, everyone. I appreciate this kind of humor. I'm a big fan of Hess and Napoleon Dynamite, Nacho Libre. And honestly, I wasn't even aware of this movie until we did Napoleon Dynamite a few months ago. And then I saw, like, other works by Jared Hess, and this was listed. And I'm like, oh, that one looks weird. And so I'm glad I watched it. But anyway, how we usually start this off is with the old Google description. So if you're ready, Dirty J, here we go. This is Gentleman Broncos. Came out October 30th of 2009, so it's almost 11 years old. Got a 6.2 on IMDb, 19% Rotten Tomatoes, and only 28% of Metacritic. However, 91% of Google users like it. The description is very short. It says, when a teenager attends a fantasy writer's convention to meet his idol, he discovers his idea for a book is stolen by the novelist and passed off as his own. The director is Jared Hess, who also did Napoleon Dynamite and Nacho Libre. It had a $10 million budget. However, it only got a box office of $118,192. I don't have the cents figure there, but I'm pretty sure that would help them out in trying to recover some of the money here. One honestly, audience reviewer does say, the best movie I have seen in weeks of quarantine, haven't laughed out loud at a movie in maybe years. So maybe we're all getting that collective. I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but Dirty J, but Saturday Night Live, when I was growing up, it went through a phase of being funny and then unfunny and then funny again, like over the course of a few years. And I came up with this term of like Saturday Night Live funny, meaning that it's only funny because you're super fucking tired and it's after midnight. So like all this dumb stuff that they were doing was actually kind of funny. This is like Chris Farley, Adam Sandler, Will Ferrell. Like that was the kind of period of time that I'm kind of referring to. But I'm wondering if that reviewer who was like, hey, I watched this in quarantine and it's actually kind of funny, is it because we're now stir crazy from all the craziness going on in the world? or do you think that, you know, he just got around to it because as you run out of content, right? I mean, you have like this smorgasbord of content available to you, but I'm sure, you know, the Netflix thing, it says, you know, you want to watch the next episode, next episode, next episode. Eventually you run out of whatever you're watching. You got to find something new. So what do you think?
I mean, yeah. Well, for one, yeah, this is definitely an acquired taste when it comes to humor, kind of like British humor. You know, some people like it, some people don't. And yeah, you know, being locked up in quarantine, you know, even if you're eventually going to run out of stuff to watch and you'll appreciate anything that gets thrown at you, including this, I guess. He didn't specify whether or not he was on any sort of substances or impaired in any way when he watched it. So that, I feel like that's unfair to judge such a positive comment without knowing the facts behind it.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me, I think Robert did say on one of our episodes a while back that, one of the movies we watched, he almost had to, he felt like it would have been a better movie had he been impaired in some way. So I wonder if that would apply to this one as well. Cause in a way, I mean, I've never, I haven't done much, but I can imagine that some of the scenery in this might be like an acid trip almost. Like you'd have to be like kind of fucked up to see this projectile vomit thing happening in the battle stags and the, you know, the gonad surgeries and all the other craziness that we see in this movie. Spoilers, everyone. All five people who saw this movie at the box office. We're talking to everyone else other than you five who saw this in the theater. But anyway, what's your take on the Google description? That's usually how we start off. And yeah, you just riff from there.
I mean, yeah, it's the Google description kind of hit the nail on the head. It left out just, you know, all the rest of the little small plot lines that they decided to throw into the movie. But yeah, the main one, you know, a kid writes a story, kid gets it stolen by some author who's going through hard times and lost his ability to write anything good. You know, he steals it and yeah. Stuff happens. Happy ending, I guess. Yeah. I mean, that's about an accurate description as I could think of.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes the description is so off that it's kind of like something to laugh at, but this, yeah, pretty straightforward. This, you can definitely tell that the director stamp is on this. Like it's definitely in that vein, the quirkiness and just like strange characters who you're not quite sure. Like there's something about them that's just off, you know, like, especially like, the girl in this who he first meets, who she's like, oh yeah, give me $40 to like buy tampons or something. And then she goes to the convenience store and just buys a bunch of crap. But she's got like this way about her that's just like super, super socially awkward. And it reminded me of Deb, the side ponytail girl from Napoleon Dynamite. Mm. Kind of that same, like, doesn't know how to like interact with other human beings in some way.
Yeah, I can kind of see that. Although the girl in Gentleman Broncos seemed to not be quite as shy and, you know, withdrawn as Deb from Napoleon Dynamite was. But I can kind of see that. That crossover. I mean, as far as I was looking for a way to describe the characters in this movie, and the only thing that came to mind was it seemed like almost every character was just high on a cocktail of random pills they pulled out of a medicine cabinet. I mean, just scene after scene, just the characters and like what they're doing and the looks on their faces and the way they interact. I'm like, there's no way there's any place like this or act like this. I don't know. Maybe I guess it's just the way the director does it. I mean, because Napoleon Dynamite similar, but I like the characters in Napoleon Dynamite. They seem to be a lot more interesting, and I don't know, maybe slightly more. Can't think of the word. Vibrant, I guess. I don't know if that's the right term, but yeah. The characters in Gentleman Broncos, they're just like what.
Yeah, I kind of see where you're going. Like, I think the Napoleon ones were, like, culturally almost iconic. Like, they stood out because you kind of can see somebody being like them, like in your normal life, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so they're memorable. Whereas in Gentleman Broncos, they just seem like just weird oddballs who don't really seem like anyone that you might know as, you know, individually, like as an audience person, you'd be like, oh, that's a weird person, but I don't know anyone like that. Where in Napoleon, it's like, oh, I kind of know someone like that. Oh yeah, I have an Uncle Rico kind of guy. Or, yeah, you know, you kind of see that kind of thing. So I wonder if that's part of it. And also I think Napoleon has a lot of rewatchability, and especially at that time when it came out, I watched it probably a dozen times in the past 10 years. This is the first time I've seen Gentlemen Broncos. So maybe there's a familiarity that kind of comes along with rewatchability, and then you kind of get used to the characters and the nuances and the differences between them. But I also think that, yeah, there's probably something too, like these are not as standout type characters. Like they, even if you watch this a dozen times, you're not going to be like, oh yeah, I totally know someone like that.
Oh yeah. And also, well, this movie came out after Napoleon Dynamite, and I think came out after Nacho Libre, right?
This would be, I think, right after Nacho.
Yeah. So, I mean, okay. So when Napoleon Dynamite came out, I have a theory about this. You know, people didn't really know what to expect. And that movie had a love it or hate it kind of crowd. You know, if either way, you're going to remember it, though. I mean, the people that loved it, you know, you'd see them quoting it all the time. Like when I was back in the day, I'd just hear people be like, gosh dang, or, you know, give me some tots, or just one of those weird little one-liners, you know. It was memorable, you know, I mean, even the people that didn't like it, you ask them like, hey, you ever heard of Napoleon Dynamite? They'll be like, yeah, I've heard of it. You know, I didn't like it. And then, you know, Nacho Libre, I tried to like that because it was Jack Black. I really tried, but it just didn't work for me. That movie was, I watched it one time. I don't even remember exactly what goes down in it, but by the time you get to this third movie, you know, people hear, oh, it's from the director of Napoleon Dynamite. Well, by then people are either like, eh, cool, another one of these, or they're like, nope, fool me once, fool me twice, you're not getting me a third time. And so even the people that liked Napoleon Dynamite were probably like, yeah, I mean, yeah, I like Napoleon, but I don't know if I want to see that kind of thing again. You know, it's like, yeah. I mean, that's probably why it got such a low box office rating, you know, or box office. And it's funny today because I guarantee I've had this experience with coworkers and friends. I bet if you go out and find 10 random people in the street, like, hey, you've heard of Napoleon Dynamite, right? Probably at least 9 of them, if not all 10, will be like, yeah, I've heard of it. Be like, what about Gentlemen Broncos? They'll be like, what? No. I've never heard of that. That was the case for everybody. I was talking to my friends and coworkers about my appearance on this podcast, and I told them the movie, and they're like, what? Never heard of that. I'm like, yeah, of course you haven't. Like 10 people have heard of it in the world.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if sports is a thing anymore with the whole pandemic, but it does remind me of like a new pitcher who's new to the big leagues and is like pitching to the lineup. And the first time through, he does really well, gets everyone out. And then the second time through, people start hitting on him. And the third time through, they're just teeing off on the guy. And, you know, cause like the batters, they get used to seeing the delivery and getting used to the pitcher and whatnot. So I wonder if that's kind of akin to, okay, Napoleon Dynamite, people didn't know what to expect. So he got a few fastballs by you. And then Nacho Libre comes out and you're like starting to pick up on his breaking ball. And then you got Gentlemen Broncos and it's like, just whiff, you're whiffing on it. Exactly. Or, you know, he's taking a yard on it or whatever. However this fucking analogy is supposed to work. Because Colin Kaepernick is in the news, especially EA Sports came out, they do the Madden franchise. Hmm. They came out and said, oh, we backtrack on, you know, this whole like Colin Kaepernick thing. We're going to add him as a playable character again. And I think one of the reasons he was so good back like 10 years ago with the 49ers was he was in a good system, but also he was like this, he was a threat to run and people weren't sure like how to contain him. So he was able to like be fairly good at being a quarterback, but then people kind of caught on to and defenses knew how to play against him and he became less and less effective. So it came down to, and this is just me theorizing a bit, but I think that his off the field actions made it more difficult for his lack of performance on the field to keep him on. you got kind of get what I was saying. Like, if he continued to play really well, then he could say pretty much whatever he wanted and it would have been fine. But he was like not playing well after a few years because defenses had figured out his tells or whatever. Like, they could figure out his snap counts or knew what his go-to plays were. So they knew, you know, he'd get sacked a lot or whatever. I'm not sure statistically, like, how much worse or better he was over the course of time, but he's not playing for a reason. And it's not just political, is my point. And so, similar to the pitcher analogy, I'm butchering this analogy, but I think that that he got figured out, right? So when he was first fresh on the scene, he was like a new kind of like player style, but now it's kind of been emulated. Like, Russell Wilson plays similar. Michael Vick was like a prototype kind of person who's a threat with his legs and with his arm. And I think these days, Lamar Jackson in the last couple of years, like, he was MVP, I think, last year. And he's like a dynamic athletic player, but I wonder if he'll also have a similar thing where, man, I'm totally butchering this, but where defenses will start figuring him out. And also his style of play. I don't know if you're familiar with like how Dwayne Wade used to play like 10 years ago, basketball for the Miami Heat. He had mad hops. Like, he was super athletic and always like trying to dunk or block or just get, like, he would get beat up basically. And when I saw him play like that, I'm like, I can't imagine how long he can continue to play at that level with as beat up as he's going to get. Like, I throw my back out getting out of the car. All right. So, you know, the last time I threw my back out was like 2 weeks ago, and I was closing a drawer, like getting socks and underwear out and closing the drawer, threw my back out for a week. So this guy gets beat up all the time. And I just figured he wouldn't be able to maintain that level of play. But Dwayne Wade, of course, you know, he played for another 10, 12 years and was phenomenal. So apparently they're made of tougher stuff than I am. But back to my butchered analogy, I think that it's a combination of defenses or the opposing side getting familiar with the style of play, and also that player wearing down because of their style of play would make him less mobile over time. Like, if you're at quarterback, you're running a lot and you're getting like tackled a lot, you're not going to be able to run as fast anymore, right? Like, if you do this for 16 games and a year for a couple of years, you're going to slow down. So I think that might be what we're looking at with Jerusha, or Jared has, his wife is Jerusha. And I think she was a co-screenwriter on this one as well. Anyway, I think I just butchered a whole bunch of stuff over the course of 5 or 10 minutes.
Believe it or not, I actually understood your analogy.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah, which could have been a simple 20-second analogy, I can turn into an 8-minute soliloquy, the Shakespearean style here. So one of the key points, I think, with this movie is the central theme of intellectual property and theft of that intellectual property. And I think you were alluding to that was one of the reasons why you thought it would be an interesting discussion point. So what to you stands out related to that argument, and what's your understanding from your perspective, like what would be kind of the libertarian or anarcho-capitalist approach to such disputes?
Well, from a personal standpoint, which I would assume would be the standpoint most people would have, was that the teacher that stole the story is he's an ass. Like, that was an immoral thing, because, you know, the kids, they put their trust in him to, you know, read their stories and give them back and judge them and everything, and he just went ahead and stole it. But, you know, but you know, when it comes to how we feel about things and how they are, it's different. Because, you know, from an ANCAP libertarian perspective, intellectual property, it's not the same as like physical property. Like, can you steal intellectual property? And like, if not, then who upholds that? The state? I mean, you know, because we want the state to be involved in as little as possible. So when it comes to intellectual property, it's not a like a physical, tangible thing. And plus, you know, from our standpoint, like, say somebody has an idea for something, I'm just going to go back in time and use generalities. Like, say I invented the cell phone, and, you know, it's a cool thing. Now, it would be cool, being that I came up with it, to be able to be the sole profiteer from it. You know, I came up with this. It's my idea. I want to be able to sell this and make money. Nobody else thought of it, but then other people, which is the case with things like that, they're like, oh, I can do this and make it better, you know, or add different features. That's why you have so many different brands of cell phones, you know, the iPhones, Androids. But intellectual property, though, when it comes in this form, like in the form of a book. Now, yes, it was immoral of, what was his name, Chevalier, whatever his name is, to steal that. But really, is there... I mean, it is immoral, but I don't see it. It's hard to explain. It's because there's no way to enforce it at all. Like even with the whole, I'm drawing a blank here.
Well, I'll help you out just a little bit. I will tell you that I think that the movie resolved it quite well and in a non-governmental way.
Yes, it did. And I was trying to, leave out the ending of it, but for now. But yeah, the movie, what was it? He was in jail for assaulting the author when he found out he stole his story. His mom comes in, tries shoving a popcorn car through the bars, you know, happy birthday. And she's like, oh, I also had all your stories registered with the Writers Guild. I still am not sure what the Writers Guild is, but apparently that did seem to resolve the issue. You know, he had like official copies that were stamped by the Writers Guild years before Chevalier wrote his pirated ripped off version. And yeah, so that right there was proof that it was an original idea by the kid. But now, but what I was trying to think of is, like, what if it wasn't resolved in that way? Like, what could he have done? Like, say there was no Writers Guild, say everything just played out. His mom never registered his story. I mean, well, you know, how would that be resolved, especially without the state? You know, it couldn't be, you know, I mean, it's just one of those things that it's kind of like you got to be careful what you do with your intellectual property, basically. Like, as much of an asshole as the teacher was for stealing the idea, I mean, yeah, but then you got all these people that are like, hey, this is this really great story I wrote, you know, and just passing it off. I mean, if I wrote something really great and I knew it was great, I wouldn't trust it to anybody. I wouldn't show it to anybody because of that fear. You know what I'm saying? So it's...
Right. So then you might seek out like a Writers Guild type situation, which is essentially a third party arbitrator who you're registering with it, date stamping with it, and they are respected in the industry. So when there is a dispute that comes into play, I mean, this is essentially that insurance model that we see in Bob Murphy's Chaos Theory. There's a third party dispute resolution provider who other parties respect, who when they say, well, it was actually Benji who wrote this story on this date, and it was submitted and stamped on this date. And we see Jemaine Clement, the character the actor who played Chevalier, he came up with the story much, much later, and he just changed a couple of pieces. So that right there tells the industry and the consumers of that product, the book publishers, the bookstores, the fans, that Chevalier is a fraud. And once Chevalier is a fraud one time, he's looked at as a fraud. You know, you fuck one dog, you're a dog fucker. You know? Or an American Pie, like, you fuck one pie, you're the pie fucker, you know. And Jason Biggs, he got called that a lot when he was like seen out and about. But it's like a reputation thing, right? So you have a third party that's respected, and so there would be a risk involved with trying to quote unquote steal someone else's story and pass it off as your own, which would be a fraud, right? That's a fraudulent thing to do. And especially if there's evidence to support, like your evidence that we actually have at least one listener, there's evidence to support that he was not the originator of that story. And so he would then suffer the repercussions from that. Had he not gone to the third party arbitrator, and granted, there aren't a lot of those kinds of things because the state exists and the state offers things like copyright and patent laws and a whole host of other regulations. So what's the right word? As just people living in today's environment, we don't think of these things because they're not top of mind. We assume they're taken care of in some ways, right? A lot of the things that the state does, we just kind of like assume that that's taken care of. Whereas if the state weren't building the roads or doing the fires, fire departments, et cetera, there would in that, in their place, spontaneously come about from competitive forces, alternatives, and different services, different price levels for those same kinds of things. So like if something's needed in the world, some entrepreneur is going to figure that out. Like they're going to find a way to satisfy consumers' needs, wants, and desires. And so just because there's something that there's some entity out there saying, oh, we're already taking care of this. You see this as an example with charity. When the government gets involved with giving grants or welfare or things like that, then people assume that, oh, there's already so much of this money going towards this, so it's being taken care of. What they don't realize is that 80 to 90% of that money is eaten up in the machinery of the government program itself, and only like 10% actually gets to whatever the purpose of that program was. Even in private charity, for the most part, I think upwards of over half of it gets used up in administrative functions. And so only half of that money gets through. One shining example is the Ludwig von Mises Institute, which I think upwards of 90% of the money that they get as donations actually goes into the programs to support providing their lecture series and all the content they have on their website available out to people. So they run very lean. But back to my original point, just because we are in a situation where we assume a lot of those things are already taken care of, then maybe you wouldn't have gone to the Writers Guild yourself in today's environment. But if the state wasn't there, then I think it would be only natural to have something like that, that, oh, if I have this story, I'm going to go here to register it, to verify, you know, get the date stamped and confirm that it's mine. There are a couple of great books related to intellectual property as it pertains to patents and copyrights. One is Against Intellectual Monopoly, and the other one is called Against Intellectual Property. And one of them is by Boldrin and Levine, and they looked at over a dozen different historical examples of a patent or copyright thwarting the progress of innovation in a particular field, and how the in their examples, how it actually worked out better when there wasn't a copyright or a patent in play. And it's kind of, I'm not explaining it very well, but they go into like basically a almost objective, analytical, empirical kind of way of approaching it. And then the other book is by Stefan Kinsella, who is, of course, a IP lawyer, Austrian economist, libertarian lawyer. And his argument is more on theory, right? So in order to have a property interest, there has to be tangible property that has a function of scarcity, right? You were talking about this a little bit earlier. So ideas aren't scarce. And once you've put them out into the world, then other people can be sparked on their end and perhaps improve on that idea. And we actually hear about that in the movie itself when he's at one of the later presentations by Chevalier, and he asks him, hey, so I had my story get made into a movie and they're making all of these changes to it. How do you as an artist approach that? And he's like, cash that check, get that money. Or at first he says, great question. Thank you for firing at me. Cash that check. We do it for the riches. And they might make the story even greater. So I guess the point of that is, yeah, you might have this particular take on the story, and then they'll get it and they'll perhaps improve it or perhaps ruin it. Who knows? But similar with cell phones, if there was just one cell phone provider, like if it was the Dirty J and that was the cell phone and we're on the Dirty J 9, right? Just came out with larger screen and the thumbprint actuator on the back, making shit up here. But if there's not a Samsung and there's not an Apple and there's not a Motorola and there's not a competitor out there who's legally permitted or, you know, they're withheld from that market of competing with you, then your phone's probably not going to be as good. It's probably going to be more expensive. It's probably not going to work as well. It's going to not have as many features. It's not going to have as much differentiation. when you have a monopoly situation, and that's what a patent attempts to do, is provide a monopoly for a period of time on a concept or idea. What do we know with monopolies? You get lower quality service, you get higher prices, and less innovation. So I think that is another shot against intellectual property. I like to coin, I'm sure they didn't coin this, but what I say is, you know, they say taxation is theft. I say intellectual property is theft. Because what you're essentially doing with intellectual property and trying to enforce patents or copyright, you're preventing other people who may or may not even be aware of your invention from doing with their own resources what they would like to do. There have been moments in history where there are sort of a, what do they call it? Like almost a simultaneous or symbiotic discovery. So like two disparate parties can discover the same thing in the same short period of time. Like, I don't know, the steam engine or whatever. So person A runs to the patent office first. Person B doesn't even know about person A. He comes up with this invention as well. And maybe it works slightly differently, but it's still like theoretically, you know, the same principle. Person A has the patent on it, so he can shut down person B. Even though person B had nothing to do with person A, didn't know about them, didn't know about their idea, came up with it on their own. So then you're using the government to prevent that person B from doing what they would do with their justly acquired resources, using their own mind, using their own labor, you know, coming up with the idea on their own. So, you know, that's another shot against intellectual property. And I'm not sure how that relates particularly to the movie, but another little mini rant for me here.
I see what you're saying. The only thing that differentiates how far you can take intellectual property or, you know, like expand on ideas, you know, like with products, you know, like, oh, I make a phone, then they make a better phone, and then they make a better phone. And that would motivate me to make my product better and cheaper and everything. And that's why, you know, having intellectual property is just kind of a dumb idea, and having it enforced by the state is a dumb idea because it prevents that kind of innovation. But it's, I mean, I'm not in favor of any sort of, you know, state entity enforcing this. Like you said, in the absence of such, you would have things like the Writers Guild, but people would have to take it upon themselves to seek them out. First of all, you know, it's not just going to be one of those things that's there. You know, if you're like an artist, a creator, or, you know, an author, you would have to seek that out in the absence of, you know, being able to get like a state copyright.
Yeah. And I think it'd become more normal. If there wasn't like this presumption that it's already kind of being handled or whatever.
Yeah. So, it kind of places the more responsibility on the person, you know, to safeguard their stuff. But now the only thing I think is it seems a little bit different with a book. Cause like we said, you know, not holding on to intellectual property means things can constantly improve. But with a book, though, once it's written, it's written. Like, how many times are you going to, like, have somebody write a book and then somebody like, oh, well, I can write a better version of that book, you know, like take like a Stephen King book or like any given Stephen King book and have somebody like rewrite it with like a slightly different name. You know, I mean, even if there's only so much you can do. To expand on something like that, and it's not something you'd see every day. Like once an idea, like a book is out there, you know, it's like a first come first serve thing. Basically, there's not really a lot any competitive entity could do to improve upon it. I mean, you know, you see what I'm saying? Unless it's a first come first serve kind of thing. Basically, like once you have the idea for a book, if you write that book and you get all your ducks in a row, then you know you're the first one to get it published and written. Then that's yours, you know. Like I don't see there being a lot of competition, not as much anyway. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. And Walter Block actually has a section on this in Defending the Undefendable. He has a book series where he takes situations where there's somebody who's in the general consciousness thought of as a bad guy, and he shows why what they're doing is actually a net good and not as harmful as people would come to believe. So one of them is the plagiarizer, the blackmailer, the slumlord. You know, he goes through a whole series of them. And I think one of the examples he talks about is the plagiarizer, I think. And I haven't looked at it in a while, but I'll find the article and I'll post it on the show notes page. But he basically makes the argument that if anything, that plagiarizer is going to be competing with the original author of the content. And so in the Stephen King example, there's no way you're going to outsell Stephen King, because if you're going to put your name, Dirty J, on it, it's going to sell like dog shit compared to if it had Stephen King's name on it, right?
Oh, yeah.
But in this movie, it's sort of the opposite situation, where you have this very popular, like the Stephen King kind of guy is taking from the Dirty J. He's taking Dirty J's story, slapping Stephen King's name on it, and marketing it out. But even in that situation, you have a guy in Chevalier who is out of ideas, or the publisher no longer likes his shtick. And so that's one of the things that motivates him to like find something else and take from someone else. But he won't be able to do that again, or at least not from the same person. Right. And similar to, you know, everyone has their own voice in their mannerisms, writing style, singers have their own, you know, singing style, musicians have their own playing style. It becomes, I think, obvious. Like we talked about Hess as a director, you can tell that this is the director of Napoleon Dynamite and the director of Nacho Libre. Okay. So similar to that, you would tell, be able to tell when someone is stealing content, because it's not their, like if they have a body of work and then there's this one thing that like sticks out and is like, whoa, this is totally unlike anything they've done before. That's going to kind of be noticeable, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. Like you're saying that, Chevalier stealing this book, stealing this idea, turning it into his own. It might be really different from his other works, but you know, he's so famous, he probably has a following where people take this and think, if they even notice the differences, they're just like, oh, this, he's trying something new, you know. So something, I don't think with somebody as big as him, doesn't seem like it would be something that would be taken notice of, especially if he's got like a big cult following, like, which he does have a big cult following. You see him at his book signing, people, you mean, already going in there cosplaying as his twisted version of Brutus, you know, just the long hair. Oh, God, that was just so bad. But yeah.
It took me a minute to realize that's Rockwell still, like the two different versions of Bronco and Brutus.
Yeah, I actually thought it was a different person the first time too. And I'm like, no, I had to watch the credits to verify it. I'm like, no, it's not the same guy.
Yeah, but it's bizarre. But yeah, I see what you're saying. But so he might be able to pull it off in like, oh, it's a bold new direction. But you got to also think of the risk he's taking, because he doesn't know that this story is submitted to the Writers Guild or some other third party. You know, one of the things that, this is going to be a weird tangent, but I did a week long firearms training with Masad Ayoub like 10 years ago. And you take notes, 4 hours a day, you're doing like classroom lecture type stuff and you're taking notes. And then, the other 4 hours you're on the range doing firing drills. And this is for a week long instruction thing. And at the end of it, all the classmates compiled all of our notes together to get like a master note, like thing. So, you know, because like you're always going to miss something. Right. But the other dozen people they might caught something that you didn't and vice versa. And so when you compare all of your notes together and create one master one, then you have a more complete set of notes. Now here's why it's relevant to the discussion here. They said to then take that master set and mail it to yourself via certified mail, get a stamp on it with the date and leave it sealed. So then if you are ever involved in a self-defense shooting, you will make this admissible in court. Your entire instruction that you've had, all of the notes that you had and all of the lesson that you had, and that then becomes admissible. So then you do what's called an affirmative defense. So you go in and you say, yes, I mean, if this is what actually happened, you say, yes, this is what happened. And this is why I did this per my training, which I received at this time. And here is all of the notes that I took at that training. And then you basically, then your legal team can then present that and essentially put the jury through your class. So then by the end of it, they're going to know, okay, here's what you were taught and why. You know, when to use force, defensive force in these situations, when you need to stop, right? Because there is the point of like, you've neutralized the threat. If you go any further, then you then become the aggressor. And I'll even tie this randomly to the events in Kenosha. So from my understanding in the Kenosha thing, the initial aggressor was the first guy who got shot. Now, the people then chasing the guy who shot him as he was retreating, at that time, they might have thought, based on the available knowledge, that the guy retreating was the aggressor, the original aggressor. And so they were trying to intervene or exact punishment on him or whatever they were, you know, trying to do. Mm-hmm. But that was one of the things in our training was, hey, if you're going to come to the defense of another, you need to be damn sure that you know who the original aggressor was. Because if you come to the aid of the original aggressor and they're still, you know, in the quote unquote aggressive legal position, then you are then an accessory or an accomplice to that aggressor's actions. And so when it comes to the Kenosha thing, those people who chased him, not knowing who the initial aggressor was, made a mistake. But also the you know, even if somebody's trying to retreat from a situation, from my understanding and from the training, they are no longer the aggressor. They're trying to get away from the situation. So that also, you know, like who the aggressor is can shift, can change.
Yeah, I still don't think we really know everything about the whole Kenosha incident. But yeah, I mean, I agree. Well, especially these, you know, those peaceful protesters, you know, I'm sure people on both sides would have a warped understanding of who or what an aggressor in any situation would be. Like even if they saw like one of their little Antifa buddies, like, hurl something at this kid first and everything, you know, they're not gonna see their comrade as the aggressor. They're gonna see the kid as the aggressor solely for just being there with a scary black gun. You know, I mean, it's hard to tell how these people think. It's hard to get into that mindset. So I don't know, without actual tangible footage, because I mean, I don't know if you can take anybody's testimony from that and have it be taken seriously, but without actual concrete video footage of how the whole thing played out start to finish, I mean, there's really no telling.
Right. And from my understanding, there's actually a fair amount of video evidence and things like that. And even of all places, the New York Times actually put together a spliced version of like time sequenced lined up all of these different angles and things. So you can actually kind of get a better impression of what actually happened. And I'm actually surprised that it was as unbiased as it appeared to be. So I gotta give credit where credit is due. Normally the failing New York Times, I'm not a big fan. But in that case, at least they weren't overly biased against somebody who was probably in a self-defense situation. Now, I don't know like all of the details like you were saying, but to me, it really looked like one guy was clearly not being aggressive. He was trying to retreat and he was being attacked and he defended himself. And, you know, I think he did better in that situation than I would have. There were people attacking him with lethal intent and he is still alive. So he did admirably as far as that goes.
Oh yeah. Even though we can't really see exactly what kicked off the whole thing. Yeah. There is plenty of video out there of him clearly defending himself from somebody attacking him. Now what their motivations were for attacking him, you know, like maybe they saw him as the aggressor in the initial conflict, you know, whatever. I just think that, okay, you don't run up on a
guy, right? We're still doing Gentleman Broncos.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to say you don't run up on a guy with a gun trying to play. If there's a guy with a gun, you don't run up and try to take it or hit him with a skateboard. I mean, you kind of get what you get when you do that. You know, if I see a guy with a gun and I have a skateboard, I'm not going to be like, hey, you drop that gun and try to hit him with this. I'm going to be like, yeah, this guy's got a gun and I move slower than a bullet does, so I'm not going to attack him. I'm just going to go this way. You know, it's just people amaze me with their choices, you know. So.
To me, it was, you know, the whole situation is a nightmare scenario. You know, all these people out there causing all this destruction and then being labeled as peaceful when they're, you know, burning buildings and destroying private businesses. It's anything but. Apparently the media is all, you know, carrying water for it because it's on message. It's on narrative, like we were talking about earlier in the pre-show. Bonus content available for Patreon supporters, lastnightage.com/Patreon. You can also see us do this thing live via the live stream. Now, no one's doing it right now, but sometimes there are people here and they're making comments. So you want to be able to do that. LastNerds.com/Patreon. All right. If I could shift this back to the movie just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like we kind of on a tangent there.
Yeah. For a little while. We're going to fish out some country balls here. So back at the time when he asks Chevalier about somebody buying his story and then making changes, he says, cash that check. And so then he goes and attempts to cash the check, and he needs money because I forget exactly why, but because some of the nightgowns that his mom was selling at her store had gone missing from inventory, and they're running a small business on very thin margins. So if somebody burns down her nightgown shop, they're going to be very, very suffering badly. So he's out selling these corn balls, two in a bag. These were terrible, terrible visual pun jokes that just fell flat for me. I mean, you're laughing about it now.
I liked them. I liked them as bad as the movie was. I got a good chuckle out of that.
I find talking about it is funnier than seeing it just because how bad those jokes were. So he ends up throwing the balls in the garbage when he goes in to try to cash this check. And then he gets to the teller, and the teller's like, you can come back in a year and we'll see if it clears. So with that, the movie producer guy, who is played by Escalito, the guy from Nacho Libre, paid him with a post-dated check for a year in the future. Now, I think that was fraudulent on his part because he did not make that a part of the conditions of the deal that he made for the $500 to buy the story. This is an example of time preference, where there's a time value of money, because money today is worth more than money sometime in the future. Like if you were to say, I'll have $500 today or $500 a year from now, what do you want? Which one are you going to pick?
Oh, I'd rather have it today, because next year it might be worth what $300 is today. Or less,
right.
You never
not
know.
Only that, but you have to wait a year to actually utilize it for something, right? To satisfy your needs, wants, and desires. So he's essentially giving himself a interest-free loan to Benji, or from Benji. He's taking an interest-free loan from Benji for the $500. He's getting the $500 of value in buying the story today, but Benji's getting some lesser value in the future, because he has to wait a whole year to be able to use that. So whatever the prevailing market rate of interest would have been, and we don't know what that is because of the Federal Reserve and federal funds rate, but let's just say it's 5 or 10%, you know, so Chevalier or Benji is only getting like $450 really when it comes down to it. And he has to wait a year to get it. So that was kind of a fraudulent thing, but also a time preference thing. And it kind of goes into like the theory of interest and why money today is worth more than money in the future, let alone the point you were making of the inflationary aspects of a fiat Federal Reserve monetary system, where they're creating more and more dollars, chasing fewer and fewer goods. And as we've seen with the quarantine and all the stimulus money that they've been doing, I'm very surprised there isn't more tangible inflation going on in the world. However, I think maybe it's just manifesting itself in home prices and in the stock market. So I think a lot of that money is what's going into those things versus so much at the grocery stores or consumer goods. But there is also a slowdown or a elimination of production of a lot of goods and services. I know a lot of farm goods, crops got turned under, pigs and chickens and cows got slaughtered prematurely. You know, potatoes got buried prematurely because there was no way to transmit them into the marketplace, into the structure of production, into the they didn't have anywhere to go because of the pandemic shutting down a lot of operations and modes of transportation. Now, a lot of that's kind of started to turn around, but essentially you actually had more money, more dollars being created to chase lesser amounts of goods and services being available. And so that's a recipe for making things go up in price, because there's a lower supply and there's more dollars chasing that lower supply. Now, the interesting thing about the house prices, I'm very surprised that people are not as risk averse as I think that people should be when we're in, if not a deep recession. I don't know what it's going to be. I mean, I feel like the actions that have been happening should get us into something akin to the Great Depression. But I've been wrong before. I'll admit it. But I would think that people would be less willing to take on long-term risk, such as buying an expensive house somewhere. But then you have these counteracting factors of, well, now people, it's been more acceptable to be able to work from home. So now you don't need to be in the cities or as close to your place of employment. You can do it remotely. Also, there's all of these peaceful protests happening and peaceful fires and peaceful looting and peaceful boarded up windows.
Well, that's driving up property value, isn't it?
Yeah, so a lot of these people are peacefully leaving the cities and moving to suburban and even country areas. I've seen the prices my wife and I have been looking at for a couple of years. We've been looking at maybe relocating to Idaho. And the prices have gone up dramatically just in the last 3 months. And it's because there's this near exodus of the well-to-do folks in these cities who no longer want to be in the cities. Now, if you're middle class or lower, you don't have the available funds and the luxury to be able to do something like that, right? Yeah. Like if you're a small business owner and your business is shut down, you're probably bleeding a lot of money. Or if you're a normal, like, you know, median wage worker in a city and your job shut down, you're not buying a house in the country and moving there. This is the, you know, the people who can work remotely and were probably doing pretty well financially and their jobs weren't shut down. So anyway, I think that's where a lot of the money's going is into housing out of the cities and then also into the stock market. Because it's back near record values. Trump talks about it all the time. But the stock market's back where it was, man. Doing a great job.
I wouldn't know exactly. I don't exactly follow the stock market. I don't have any stake in that kind of thing. But I mean, yeah, I can see everything that's going on though. You know, home values are going to skyrocket in some places and property values, just mainly in these areas with all these protests, are going to plummet. And yeah, I guess it's, the way you said it is basically that you think there'd be like a major depression by now, but it just seems that money is still flowing. It's just going to different places, kind of. So that's probably what's keeping everything afloat, right? That's kind of what you were saying.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these things have like they take time to manifest, right? So, and I remember in 2008, a lot of the things I was reading were like, nobody knows you're in a recession until after the fact. Like it's a backward looking thing, like, oh, we entered a recession as of, you know, this date in the past. And I think that's actually how they define them. Like it's two successive quarters where it's like negative or under a certain amount of growth. Negative growth is what they call it. You know, they change all the fucking words. We were talking about that earlier in the pre-show, I think.
Negative growth.
How the dictionary changed all like 15,000 entries. But yeah, so they changed depression to recession, and then they changed growth to negative growth. You can't say shrink or, you know, loss or whatever. You have to say negative growth. Anyway.
Negative growth. It's like jumbo shrimp or civil war, you know.
Military intelligence. All right. So I have a couple of more notes, and then we should probably start to wind this down. Back to when he was cashing the check and he put those country balls in the garbage. When the check fails to clear, he realizes, oh shit, now I have to go and sell these. So he did the George Costanza eclair. It was on top move of pulling the balls out of the garbage to then sell them. So that was kind of cute.
What you got to do.
And then the intellectual property thing, there was a point where the movie came out and it was on this like local talk show, whatever. And Chevalier sees it. He's like, calls up the publisher. He's like, can we sue them? You know, can we stop them? I hate plagiarism. And that was just like this totally, you know, rejection thing that you see all the time where the person who's guilty, they'll accuse others that which they are guilty of and feign like being so upset about it. And I don't know, it's maybe a psychological phenomena, but it's a thing that I've heard of and am familiar with. And I've seen it happen where the person who's actually doing that thing will blame someone else for doing it and be outraged, feign outrage over it. So great example of that movie.
Oh yeah, that was yeah, that part stuck out for me. I'm just, I saw that scene and I'm like, really, dude, really? You're gonna play that card? But it depends on what's actually considered plagiarism. Because like you said, at that point in the movie, the only person that knew that story was officially, you know, had its stamp of approval from the Writers Guild was the mother, who I guess, and I guess the Writers Guild himself. But I'm not sure if that would be their place to come out amidst this book and be like, hey, no, somebody already wrote it. You know, it just seems like, yeah, I'm not really exactly sure what they do, but yeah, I mean, this was before all that was revealed, but would you, I mean, is it still considered plagiarism if he just stole the idea from something that up until the end we thought was just some musings of a kid jotted down in a journal? You know, I mean, at that point, it was assumed that it was completely unpublished, you know, and that there was like nothing backing it at that point. I mean, I don't know if it would technically be plagiarism. I mean, maybe it would, but maybe to Chevalier, it technically wasn't, because it's not like he found this kid's story at a bookstore and was like, huh, yeah, I'm just going to take this already published work and change some names and throw it back out there, you know? So, I mean, I guess I'm kind of trying to justify his reaction there, because like by the time he saw that movie, his book was already on the shelves, wasn't it? Like,
I don't know if it was on the shelves yet, but it was in the midst of being published. But I think that he was well aware that he was committing plagiarism.
I said, it could be subjective. Like, maybe he didn't see it as plagiarism because it was just some high school kids freaking sci-fi story that nobody else knew about. So, I mean, right. I don't know.
Well, the thing with the movie was the changes to the movie had upset Benji from the original movie. So the movie itself was more different than the plagiarized version that Chevalier did, because all he did was change some names.
Yeah, that is true. It didn't really go into great detail what all these changes were. There was like one scene, I think, where you knew there were some changes where Benji's standing there like reading the script and they say a few lines different and he's just like looking at the script and he's like, hell, and he closes the book and storms off. They didn't really give us an idea of how much they changed it, but it was enough to make him mad.
Well, are you talking about in the movie, the adaptation?
Yeah. We know they changed some stuff in the movie, but it just doesn't give us an idea of like how in depth they changed. Like I said, there was only that one scene where Benji was like watching the movie being filmed and he's like flipping through the script like, oh, I don't remember writing that. And then he just kind of storms off. And
yeah,
and you only see a few other scenes throughout the movie of them continuing to film it. So I don't know.
Yeah. My take on what upset Benji about the movie was they added this romantic angle. If you remember, they Escalito and the snake guy, the guardian angel guy, like had a kissing scene, and then they're like, oh, let's go lay down in my chamber or whatever.
Okay. So that was a love scene. I guess.
I'm sure he didn't write in his novel or his book, but they added to, you know, spice up the movie. And then when he was reading a passage from the published book of Chevalier's book, it was the scene about the passage was about removing the testicles of Brutus. And he's like, wait, this is definitely my Bronco story. He just changed the names. And he turned Bronco into a tranny or transvestite. I think he said that. Because remember, you know, how we were confused. I got banned from Facebook for like a week for saying that or writing that. So I have to say transmission or transformer. Transformer or
they're more than meets the eye.
I think trans is okay to say.
Okay.
I think. So yeah, he was upset that all he did was change Bronco to Brutus. He changed a couple of other character names, and he made Bronco a trans individual. And Rockwell played the two different versions of the character. Like the I don't know what would you call it, like sequences where it's like Benji imagining the story. It's like the background behind me here where he's got like the permed hair.
Yeah.
And then when it's the Chevalier version, he's got the platinum blonde wig style hair.
I mean, despite the fact that the whole thing was horrible, if I had to pick a version, I would pick Benji's version, because you know how it swapped back and forth between their two versions. And I'm just like, man, yeah, Chevalier really just butchered this whole character. He turned him into this effeminate, like, kind of character. While just the other guy actually seems like he's some kind of an action hero. You know, I'm like, yeah. And you say earlier in the movie, they were talking about, well, somebody might take your idea and make it better. I think he arguably made it worse.
yeah, exactly. All right. You know what? I think we should wind this down and then save some more stuff for the Kathleen Turner Overdrive's bonus content we have for people who subscribe to the show on Patreon. So lastnerds.com/Patreon, everyone, get some pre-show and post-show bonus content. So if you don't have any other points you want to make at this moment, would you like to give the summary and review? And you can score it out of 10 battle stags. How many battle stags would you score this, Gentleman Broncos?
How many battle stags? Well, like I said, initially I hated the movie when I saw it for the first time, and then I watched it a couple more times, and it's still terrible, but it's terrible in a way where it almost makes it likable. Kind of like how the movie The Room with Tommy Wiseau, you know, that how that became a cult classic and people liked it because of how horrible it was. That's kind of how this movie is for me. Yeah, I'm gonna give it a five. Just and that's being generous, but that's only because I feel like after rewatching it, I was able to get entertainment out of it after the third or fourth time seeing it.
Okay, five battle tags.
Solid five.
Solid five out of 10, right?
Out of 10.
10, yep. 10 battle stag missiles. So five battle stag missiles. Yeah, there we go. All right. Well, I want to commend you for suggesting this movie. It's one I wasn't even aware of until we did Napoleon Dynamite a few months ago. And even at that, I wasn't like super interested in watching this. I actually looked at the trailer at the time and I was like, I don't know about this one. But when you suggested it, you made it happen, and I'm glad that I did. This is the type of movie, and Robert hates these types of movies. He hates it when we do comedies and these irreverent, like, goofy fucking ones. But I always find something to talk about. And, you know, it's weird because we just did The Godfather, and we could only do part of what we were wanting to discuss. So we're going to do a second part of that. But it's like such an involved movie, and it's done so well. And I find that it's difficult for me to approach an episode on a movie like that, where there's just so much to talk about. And it's like such a heavy subject matter and it's like serious. Whereas where these goofy fucking movies, I'm like, oh yeah, take like three or four notes, make some points, do a few quotes, boom, episode. You're welcome, everyone. But this kind of fits into that. And because I'm a fan of Napoleon Dynamite, and I'm a fan of Nacho Libre, I think that you should give Nacho Libre another shot. We actually did that one for Cinco de Mayo a couple of years ago. So I'll send you a link for that, and I'll put it on the show notes page as well. You might get a new appreciation for it. The characters and Jack Black, I think, do a fine job. Just so you know, Robert hated that movie, as I'm sure he hated this one. But for me, I'm going to go with 7 battle stag missiles out of 10. I'm a fan of Hess's work, and this just kind of like resonated with me with just how campy and bad it was, but in an entertaining way. And I might even give it another watch. And you know, audience, we might do a bonus episode related to this, perhaps later on this week, because Robert might recover from the peaceful wildfires that have peacefully cut him off from the internet. So we might have Dirty J back on again, and we'll get Robert's take on this. So this might be bonus. This might be the official episode. You might get another portion that is going to then be the bonus. I don't even know. It's like a mystery. We're going to have Chevalier come in and rewrite this thing, turn it into some other version, put platinum blonde wig hair on me, and maybe we'll give it another shot. So anyway, I think I gave it, 7 battle stags? You gave it 5. Robert's going to go probably 2, maybe 2.5 battle stags. That's just going to be my guess. So we'll see what happens there. But Dirty J, thank you so much for recommending this. I do appreciate it. And also thank you for being a trooper and doing this episode with just me. I know it's weird because I ramble and don't make points. That's what I have Robert for. But, you know, he's my guardian angel. He doesn't have a snake, but I think after seeing this, maybe he'll get one. But anyway, do you have any final comments you want to make or anything you want to let the audience know? Do you have anything you want to, like, mention? Do you have a website or do you want people to follow you anywhere? Anything like that? You can say no. It's fine, too.
No, I mean, I don't have anything going. I don't have a website. I mean,
Well, thanks for coming on, and it was a lot of fun. And we'll continue yucking it up a little bit in some Kathleen Turner Overdrive. So thank you, audience, for hanging out with us for this one. Give us the likes and subscribes on the old iTunes and YouTube and all that stuff. If you leave us comments or ratings and reviews, we do appreciate that. It helps with the algorithms and whatnot. Click the bell icon below to see our new videos and subscribe over there. You know how you hear that at all the YouTube videos? Like, they have this, like, memorized thing. I'm so bad at this, I don't even know what they say. I tune it out at that point, and I listen to everything at double speed. Usually, like, Dave Smith's part of the problem. Anyway, I'm rambling again, yet again. Anyway, this is our episode on Gentlemen Broncos, everyone. So tune in next week. We're going to be getting more serious again with Jared Wall of Breaking Liberty. He was on with us for Captain Phillips Gold and El Camino, the Breaking Bad movie. So he's been a multi-time guest, and he's going to come back next week talking about Hotel Rwanda, the Don Cheadle movie about the Rwandan genocide against the Tutsis, I believe. I haven't seen it in a long time, but it will be our next episode. So it's going to be a heavier episode next week. So join us for that with Jared, and hopefully Robert's internet is restored by then. So Ben, thanks again. And audience, thank you. We'll see you guys all next week. Peace out. Good night from last night. All right, we're going to continue the transmission just a bit longer on the Actual Anarchy podcast before we get into the Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is the bonus content. This is episode 198 of the Actual Anarchy podcast. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/198. We're going to have a bunch of links to books and articles and things related to intellectual property. There's even an article on the website, actualanarchy.com, related to intellectual property written by Freedom Juice, which is really good primer on intellectual property. And then I think I also wrote one a while back that kind of just has some, you know, my random thoughts and musings about different facets of intellectual property and why it's kind of bullshit and why I consider it theft. But while we're still here, I have one more question related to the movie for you, Dirty J.
All right.
We didn't even touch on this, but the lingerie magnet that the mom is invited to, and there's this misunderstanding.
Yeah, I know what
she's there for, like, he's trying to solicit like a hookup. And he says to her in like an email or whatever, however he invited her, like, hey, bring your lingerie, bring everything or bring whatever. She thinks, oh, it's bring my collection of things I designed and try to sell. And he's the biggest, you know, in the field in this market. And he wants to like maybe promote my stuff. Well, so he thinks it's a booty call, and she gets confused and offended. And Benji threatens the guy. Now, we were talking about the Kenosha situation. Benji threatens him, but then the guy has a gun, and he starts shooting at Benji. Like, action hero style, like, unlimited Rambo ammunition in a revolver. You should have, at maximum, 6 rounds. I think he shoots like 14 times before going to get additional ammunition. Anyway, my thoughts on that were that he went way too far, and he should have just said to Benji, hey, get off of my property. You're no longer welcome here. And only if Benji persisted in trying to attack him for what had happened to his mother, then maybe there's a call for, you know, a defensive situation. But it seemed to me that this was a case where, you know, the director, screenwriter probably has a certain perception on guns. And we see it kind of played out in this movie where he thinks, oh, anyone with a gun is potentially super dangerous and reckless and going to, you know, just go around shooting up cars and putting people at risk, that kind of a thing. What was your overall impression of that scene?
Well, yeah, I kind of agree with you. He did go a bit too far, but I mean, up until Benji got out and what did he threw a statue through the guy's window after shouting at him like
peacefully.
Peacefully, of course. Yeah. You know, up until that point, I mean, yeah, it was kind of a horrible situation. You know, his mom shows up there and she thinks big clothing designer's gonna like talk to her about featuring her designs in his clothing line, and he's just like, go in and take your clothes off, and then she comes out crying and everything. And up until then, it was an uncomfortable situation, but you know, he said something uncomfortable, she left, and then at that point Benny kind of became the aggressor, maybe not so much at, you know, shouting at him, you know, but when he threw that statue through the dude's window, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I would have immediately opened fire at that point, but you know, I can kind of see, you know, if somebody throws a statue through your window, reaching for a gun, you know, isn't exactly a bad move. You know, but yeah, he did go over, like, I would have been like, yo, I would have been like, get the hell off my property before I call the cops or I shoot you or something. You know, just immediately opening fire was a bit too much, I think. But was he justified? I mean, he didn't open fire until he peacefully threw a statue through his window. So, I mean, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a very prescient move, actually, with the whole removing of statues and destroying them. That became very prominent 10 years after the movie came out.
Oh, yeah. So it's like foreshadowing.
Yeah. Maybe it's like a Nostradamus thing. But yeah, I think it was just an embellished kind of scenario that played out. I mean, it's a quirky, irreverent movie, and I think it was just played up for the, I don't know, just the ridiculousness of it. Now, I will say that I think, what was his name? Don Julio, something like that. The lingerie magnate who was going to
deliver
stuff in all the JCPenney stores. I think he thought he had communicated a certain message to her and she just misinterpreted or misunderstood it. So I don't think he was necessarily in the wrong, though it also sounded like it might have been almost like a casting couch situation, like, hey, if you do this, I'll give you the part.
Mm.
So if you do this, I'll sell your stuff in all the JCPenney's around the country. So maybe he knew it's like a Harvey Weinstein, right?
Mm.
He was the guy who was kind of doing that, allegedly, peacefully. So maybe it's kind of like that, where he thought he was like doing a quid pro quo, and she thought it was just, oh yeah, show me your stuff, and if I like it, we'll sell it.
So I feel like the Don Julio or whatever his name is. Yeah, I feel like it is that second scenario where it's like casting couch kind of thing, but I feel like he's probably done it so many times, and you know, with probably arguably younger, hotter women, you know, and you know, yeah, quid pro quo, you know, and they didn't make a big deal of it. You know, then this, you know, nice little naive Christian church going mom comes in who legitimately thinks he's interested in her clothing, and you know, yeah, I guess she just doesn't know how the world works, I guess. The naivety, I don't know if I'm saying the word right.
Naivete. Like, add a little flourish.
Yeah, naivete. Yeah, you know, I mean, I get it. You know, this guy was probably expecting her to just be like, oh, okay, and anything to get my name on some clothes and some stores. But, you know, she's definitely more wholesome of a woman than the other clientele he's had, I'm guessing. Because I feel like not a lot of women have probably stormed out of his mansion crying, or else, you know, he might not have been in that position.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, and another character that she's played in the past, like about 10 years prior, Stifler's mom, probably would have been down with that, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's true. I forgot about that movie. It's been a while since I've seen that one. I think the last movie was it? The last movie I remember seeing her in, it was a parody of the Narnia movie. It was like, it was called Epic Movie or something like that, where she plays the White Queen parody. Oh. I think they colored the white bitch instead of the white witch. Like, it's the white bitch. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, I know they've done a bunch of those, like Epic Movie, Disaster Movie, Scary Movie. Like, they're these send up kind of things, like Hot Shots and Hot Shot Part 2. Oh, yeah. In that vein, yeah. I haven't seen any of them just because that, I don't know. I like quirky and I like comedy, stupid comedy, but when they go that far, I think it's like dumbed down a bit. Like, I want there to be a little bit of like, you got to have a bit of nuance to appreciate it. So I don't know. Maybe I need to give those a chance. We'll see.
Yeah, they're entertaining. I haven't seen them in forever, but yeah, they're worth watching at least once.
All right. Well, maybe I'll, you know, if I run out of quarantine fare to watch, maybe I'll get into one of those Epic or Scary Movie or whatever.
I mean, you already watched Gentleman Broncos. I mean, there's really nowhere to go from there but up, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. I still want to say what the hell, man. But no, it was a good movie. So, yeah. And thanks for the discussion as well. It's been a lot of fun having you on. I think, you know, as long as at least one person's laughing, you've been laughing, I've been laughing, it's a good show.
All right.
And let's see, everyone, this is episode 198 of the show. Find the show notes more, actualanarchy.com/198. You can like, subscribe, hit up iTunes, give us reviews, all that stuff. We've got a Patreon. Go to actualanarchy.com/Patreon. I've got a couple of other things in the works that might be a lot of fun. And we'll be doing Hotel Rwanda next week with our buddy Jared Wall. So stick around for some Kathleen Turner Overdrive after this. And I will say maximum freedom, everyone. Peace out.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do 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 do.